Well, we have quite a wide-ranging overview of some of the current issues in risk management, I think, from those four presentations. So I encourage you to keep sending through questions. I think just to kick things off, and I'm happy for any of you to respond to this, on the one hand, we had a number of people mentioning lines of defence and what I would call the negative side of risk management, trying to make sure that bad things don't happen or to limit damage if it does. But we also had a couple of speakers talking a little bit about the opportunities side of risk management, that is, trying to grasp and take advantage of things that on the upside and possibly even have risk management systems that identify those opportunities before other people do. Do any of you want to comment on that and whether you actually have built into the frameworks that you've built in your various organisations formal processes for identifying opportunities?
I can take that. Look, as I said, I think it's really important that you do that because that's where you can actually deliver real value. One of the previous presentations looked at the importance of actually being able to attribute dollars and cents to this in order to garner additional support. And what I've seen done in organisations is a program of recording of risk. So you have you have your risk register or whatever other mechanism you use to record risk. And then if that risk ever materialises, or if there is ever a cost associated with that, or if you ever suffer a loss as a consequence of that list, you can put a dollar value next to it and try and encourage that sort of reporting. So no longer is it just reporting of things that might happen. It's this happened. Had we have had the appropriate controls in place to prevent it, it wouldn't have happened, and the cost of this is X dollars. If you can actually work out ways of gathering that information, compiling it all into one place, then you can get a real report of the dollar consequence. So what we've done is actually implemented a system whereby you can access our risk register and record incidents against it. And we have a very, very granular practice of identifying these risks. You can log in, record a dollar value against that risk, and then that is captured each quarter when we prepare the board reporting. And that does allocate dollar values to it.
Okay. We have one relatively provocative question from the audience. In good economic times, how do you differentiate good risk management from sheer good luck? Anyone like to take that one? I suppose the converse is you always have to worry about the fact that you might not always be in good economic times, but somebody might suffer sheer bad luck as well. Any observation?
Well, I think if you have as part of your... I'm not sure if this is working, whether you can hear me or not.
Try that.
I'll try this one. If you have as part of your business decisions, so one that's gone particularly well in this example, if you have as part of that a risk discipline, and so risk is an essential part of that business decision, then I think you're not faced with the question of was it just good luck or good risk management, because you have just applied your risk management process effectively. Now, clearly, you can be, you know, on the right asset just before a bubble and sell at the top or whatever, and you may actually get a very good financial outcome by having very poor risk management practices. So there are learnings there as well.
Okay. Question for you, Rob. Given your experience in Europe and the fact that the ORSA process in Europe is analogous, I think, to ICAAP processes here that all of our insurers have been going through recently, do you have any suggestions or main issues that have arisen from the implementation of those sorts of processes around the world that you think are worth sharing to see what the learnings may have been?
Yeah, I think the... this is on, yeah? I think one of the main issues, actually, is what I referred to when I was speaking was just the approach to the whole ERM framework development, and whether firms have been really clear enough right at the outset to say, actually, what are we going to get out of all of this investment. And what firms now in the UK particularly are actually realising is they've spent a hell of a lot of money on implementing what they think is going to give them some great insight into, you know, their risk program. And actually all they've done is implement, if you like, the infrastructure to enable them to then take that next step. So if you look at the sort of maturity profile, risk profile, you know, you'll start, it's almost like a hockey stick. You know, you start very much down here, not having a lot. Suddenly there's a lot of regulatory pressure because it usually, unfortunately, still is regulatory driven. And I think that's another issue for the industry. We need to move beyond, you know, worrying about what the regulator wants to actually, you know, driving better business performance ourselves. And then suddenly there's this great investment that goes on in terms of putting systems, controls, processes, governance, in place, whether that be around, you know, credit market liquidity, insurance risk measures, you know, you name it, there's a whole lot of investment that goes into actually building the infrastructure. And then when they get to that point at the top, after they've spent that sort of investment, then they're saying, well, what are we getting for it? And actually, they're still not getting what they think they ought to be getting, because all they've done is enable, if you like, the data and the processes to actually work, if you like, to how they should. And so there's a next step, which actually is, well, to really derive value, we've now got to go through a process of taking a step back and saying, okay, we've put the hardware, if you like, in place. What is it now that actually we can glean from actually these tools? Now, most of the firms in the UK, and this is really interesting with the whole ORSA Solvency II aspect, you know, we said, well, here's where you need to go. If you're advising them, you'd say, this is where you need to go in totality. And most of the firms said, well, we're not sure we want to spend that much, actually. What can we do that just gets us, and you know, gets the FSA at the time, now the PRA, off our back effectively? You know, what is it that we can just, you know, make sure we can tick for their purposes? And that's unfortunately what has happened. So you're now getting another, you know, wave of concerned, you know, C-suite members sort of saying, well, we've just spent an awful lot of money. What are we really getting out of this? Now we probably need to go back and look at how we can make this work better. And, of course, you know, how can we streamline and how can we get the efficiencies? And then you're sort of spending more money, if you like, going back over something that you should have probably put in the first place. And so that would be the lesson to, the key lesson coming out of that is be absolutely clear what it is you really want this framework to be delivering at the end of the process. And then you can have some, you know, better idea as to, you know, how you then might build that going forward.
Okay. Now we've got a question that's come through about operating risk being a fairly big focus from APRA at the moment. What's the panel's view of the measurement of this nebulous risk as a valuable tool for management within insurance? Do you want to sort of perhaps start on that one, Bruce?
Yeah, I was going to say, and it depends on, to me, my perception is what you want to measure it for. If you want to get a number out of it and then use a number in the same way you use, say, insurance risk or asset risk, then you can do that. But to me, the bigger focus with op risk is really trying to understand what causes what within your organisation. Because if you like, if I use a plane analogy, it's really, are my wings still on and is my rudder still working, rather than where you're heading. And so you're looking for lots of causal factors. Does this cause that? Does that cause that? So if this occurs in the outside world, how does that impact on our capability to react in an operational sense, but also internal problems? If these problems arise, how well does our operation bounce back from those, which is kind of the resilience concept. So to me, it's not totally about getting a number, although you can get that number. It's trying to find out what happens, and then what do we do when that thing happens, and how good are we at bouncing back from that? And that's a little more than numbers, and it's more into the cultural side. But I think that's kind of where you've got to head with op risk.
I think ops risk is a very unique area of risk, in that if you look at asset risk or market risk or insurance risk, typically those categories are best led from the top. They're very sort of for want of a better expression, they're very governance focused. They're led by senior people within the organisation. I think OpsRisk failings and issues with OpsRisk are far better identified, as I tried to tease out in my presentation, at a more junior level. It'd be very rare, for example, that your CEO or your chief risk officer would necessarily understand all the potential operational failings in the call centre of an insurance business or a bank. The management tools have to be consequently very different. I think what tends to happen in my experience is that senior executives and boards have a very good understanding of those areas of risk, which are those more senior levels. And they typically don't understand ops risk very well, would be a general observation that I would make. And consequently, you need to build the tools necessary to try and educate as to the operational profile of the business once you go beyond that middle management level.
Well, that probably leads us towards one of the other questions here about risk culture. And people have talked about the tone at the top, but you also talked about the challenge of embedding the risk culture all the way through the organisation. And indeed, APRA yesterday were making it very clear that they expect boards now to be able to satisfy themselves that they actually know what the risk culture is and are happy with what it is, and not just in the senior management team. So I'd be interested in the reaction of all four of you, actually. I mean, what steps are you taking or planning to take in response to APRA's challenge there to the boards, because clearly the boards are going to need to have something that they can hang their hat on when they respond to that sort of thing, and I think they're looking more for, I think APRA's looking for more than just platitudes.
Yeah, I don't mind starting from an ex-supervisor's perspective as well. I thought it was really interesting what Ian was saying yesterday, because he was saying, well, APRA won't actually come out with anything yet. And you do, that's the old supervisory trick. You do that when you actually don't know what it is you want to see. So we did that at the FSA in the UK when we developed ICAS. Actually, we didn't really know ourselves what a good internal model looked like. So we didn't necessarily want to say to the industry, well, this is what you've got to contain, because we knew that what we would get back would be just exactly what we had prescribed, in a sense. So we were absent in terms of the guidance around that, and said to the industry, well, this is what we want to see you develop. Here are some broad sort of high-level principles, effectively. Go away and come back. Now, there's a lot of criticism around, well, what is it exactly you're wanting to see? Is it this much or is it that? And we said, well, you know, that's up to you to determine. And that's exactly what APRA are effectively doing around risk culture. And it's probably the right approach as well for a supervisor to take, because I think APRA knows that if they came out with a set of guidance points, the industry here would pretty much go away. You know, it's the same in the UK and Europe, and pretty much give them back almost line for line what their points initially were. So the challenge is on the boards, and one of the best ways we advise firms, because you know we've done a lot of this work as well in the UK, is actually demonstrating through whether it be board minutes or other sorts of communication material that actually there has been a robust challenge process there, and that there has been significant engagement from board members, the board risk committee, and others around risk. And around one of the findings of a risk review process, for example. And once you've gone through, say, a 12-month period, actually, what have you done out of those lessons you've learned from that, say, preceding 12 months? And what have you done then to, actually make things better, for the next 12 months? And how does that feed back into strategy and your other management plans? And that's the best way of demonstrating that actually you're taking it properly, and that you do view, risk generally as a quite serious issue. Now, that's the sort of, and when they talk about culture, what they're looking for as supervisors is, actually what are you doing on a day-to-day basis? The use test sort of example that we have in Solvency II, for example, is it something you're just giving lip service to, or is it something you're actually doing? And the best way of proving culture is by, through your actions. And that's our advice to most of the firms in the UK.
Do you have some other observations?
Yeah, I think too, it's also, in addition to that, I totally agree, it's also about our role as interpreters, if you like, for ERM. Some of the language we use tends to be overly technical, and part of the journey you have to take the board and the senior executive on is actually turning it into their language of their business language and then incorporating it into those discussions in that way. It's not a matter of bringing up the way you speak about it. It actually has to be of use to someone from the other side. So in those discussions, a lot of it is actually demonstrating to the board what they, you know, the, almost an education process as to how to think about this, how it interacts with their world and how the, what the value it brings to their world.
Well, I guess I'd just throw in the observation that certainly I'm aware of one organisation in the past that very formally, regularly did surveys of its all its staff, everybody right down to the coalface, and sought to ask questions like, is it safe to speak up around here? And have you been appropriately trained for your job? Or do you think you've been appropriately trained for your job? And a few other leading questions like that, which allowed an evaluation to be done of in quite small parts of the organisation as to whether the risk culture seemed to be okay. And it proved to be an extremely valuable tool, and the board took great interest in it in the end. But I think that's probably the sort of thing that actually is going to have to become more normal going forward, because what we actually found was that it actually was a really good leading indicator of operational risk, ironically, over a period of about 5 years. Usually it showed you first whether it was going to be a problem before it showed up somewhere else. So anyway, I think, you know, in response to that question, I think that's probably the sort of thing that would be quite valuable anyway, helping, showing to APRA that you actually had some way of knowing whether different parts of the organisation were better than others, which is one of the other things that did send to show it was not very uniform across the organisation.
And those sorts of surveys are not unusual in corporates already. I mean, on the operational risk side, a lot of organisations use fraud risk surveys as an example to get a measure of the likely levels of fraud risk in the culture, and employee satisfaction surveys likewise for similar reasons. So it's not unusual for employees to see those sorts of surveys, and as you say, the output is generally very valuable.
I mean, I agree with you, Tony, that I think boards, senior management will need to access some specific data on such topics. I tend to think of culture as a topic rather than just risk culture, because I think if there's a good culture in the organisation, then an essential part of that will be a risk culture. And I think if there's a perception or we see that there's perhaps insufficient tone from the top or whatever, then in my view that's just unsustainable in an entity in this day and age. And so we need to influence. If that's the situation, then we need to influence so that changes.
I think tone at the top is a necessary but not sufficient condition for good risk culture, if I can turn it around that way. You can have good tone at the top, but the risk culture is not necessarily embedded. Obviously, if you don't have good tone at the top, it's very difficult to embed it without a change. Just checking a couple of these other questions. I suppose we talked a bit about the culture, but the question there, changing the perception of ERM within an organisation from a back office to a front office function is a big challenge. What are your views on how best to achieve this change? Any of you want to tackle that one?
I think it's not a short-term task. I'll put that one out there. Again, I think it's back to me, changing the perception is about what value you're bringing to this, and can people actually see the value and make the value useful for the business decisions they have to make. So at whatever level they are within the organisation, how do you make ERM valuable to them, and how do you make it in a language with which they can use every day? And I think probably the other observation I'd make is that, to be a little provocative, we make it very boring for them. If you have to fill out a risk register for something that you intuitively know, what you're doing is codifying something you're thinking. And so the issue becomes, how do I make that a more interesting exercise, even as a basic thing? You know, lots of people now are using different types of media and different types of apps to do things. Why do I continually make them type things out? Is there another way to do it? So they're kind of some of the things we're starting to explore as well, how to make it a little more interesting to actually interact with risk. But that's a watch this space. That's a, not a short-term exercise either.
And Tony, I'd just add to that. I think you just, for a lot of firms, actually, when they undertake all of this, you know, significant spend on ERM, you sort of say to them, and what methodology have you actually got to, at the end of the process, assess whether that's actually been valuable or not? You know, how will you know to, you know, what can you report back to, whether it be the board risk committee or the board itself, you know, actually what those enhancements have been or the greater insights that you're actually deriving from this ERM framework now. And surprisingly, not enough consideration is given to those aspects. And I think this is why, you know, ERM functions, if you like, suffer a little bit in terms of being able to demonstrate the value that they've brought to it. Because there is a perception still, particularly in the UK and Europe, that risk is still seen as a bit of a cost function. And it's something we have to do because the regulators require it. Well, you know, I sort of would say to any CRO, well, you know, it's within your gift to actually be able to change that. But the only way you can do that is really to change those perceptions, is actually have some robust methodology in place that says, actually, on a variety of key measures, you know, this is how we know we're adding value. So it might be, you know, we've had a look at our intergroup reinsurance arrangements, and actually we can take more risk here, intergroup, rather than sending it out. Well, you know, there's a, you know, a bottom line, you know, contribution to that. And you can go all the way through, you know. First line's, you know, a bit heavy-handed with its risk analysis process, doesn't need all those controls in place. We can strip some of that back. You know, there's a bottom line contribution to it. You know, we've actually done a better analysis of our investment base, you know, and actually we can invest these assets more wisely, you know, and that will contribute, you know, more revenue. So you can actually start to, you know, if you have a methodology in place around some of those key issues, you actually are then able to have quite a defensible, you know, piece of argument in which to say, look, we really are adding value to this process. It's not just a compliance exercise. And that's the sort of, I think, environment that most CROs and risk functions now sort of need to move into progressively going forward.
So if I can just move towards concluding the session a little bit by asking each of you, with your respective organisations, what is it that keeps you awake at night? What are the risks that you think are in the top couple that worry you? Maybe with you first, Bruce.
Well, life insurance, it's the usual. It's claims and retention. This is the basic. They're the basic day-to-day things that keep you up at night. I think in the very longer term, it's making sure you are around to pay claims. You have a very long-term 60-year relationship with a client. If you're buying life insurance at 25 and, you know, the average age is 80-something, then that's our job as well, is to be there for that time. So it's a long-term view, and it's not a short-term profit focus on year-to-year, although that's very important, but they're kind of short-term and long-term for us.
Well, one of the risks I see going forward is particularly around recovery resolution planning work, and actually firms not having sufficient insight into, you know, those sorts of events and what they might do in those really stressed scenarios, because I think there's not enough work on the risk function that has actually gone into looking at some of that analysis. And that's clearly where the regulators are going globally on the banking side, and it will happen on insurance. And I think it will cascade down, you know, to every firm, not just a GC or a DC, but it'll be over time just seen as another part of good risk management. And the sooner firms get into that sort of analysis and start thinking about some of those issues, I think the better they can control some of those outcomes.
Well, actually, I sleep pretty well at night, Tony, thank you. But a couple of thoughts. I think uncertainty and the unknowns are things that perhaps we don't foresee are things that I think occupy my attention. I mean, we have models and that helps us to sometimes quantify the uncertainty, but they've got limitations and we need to fully understand those. So in the life insurance space, Rob mentioned, Bruce rather, sorry, did we see this coming? How many of us 5-10 years ago saw this coming? And the other one for me, and I guess one that often I put in towards the top of a list if I'm sort of ranking my top 10 risks, is reputation. And for me, reputation is just enormously valuable to an enterprise, and it takes a long time to build, and so we need to take a lot of care to look after the reputation.
And for me, I think the rate of regulatory change, and that isn't just APRA, it's ASIC, it's privacy legislation, it's all the other changes that are happening that are putting an increasing burden on us. And secondly, I'd repeat my mantra of technology, but within technology, the specific area of reputation risks, the use of social media and the risk that social media can cause significant harm to a brand, particularly for a brand like ours, which is trying to establish itself in the marketplace. So we have to be constantly cognizant of that.
Okay. Well, on that note, I think we'll conclude this morning's session. And it just remains for me to thank all of our four speakers. And if I can ask you to all thank them in the usual way.